My good colleague, Colonel Jeff McCausland, United States Army retired, CBS News artilleryman. And he is also a Dickinson College visiting professor, CEO of Diamond Six Leadership and Strategy. We're speaking of a book that was published in 2012 that is a challenge today because almost all of the work that was done in the 20th century, in fact, all of it, I'll be sweeping about this, about nuclear weapons, is mooted by the conflict in Europe, mooted by the challenge of NATO to defend its frontier, mooted by the ambition of certain new states in NATO from the original Cold War. That would be Poland, the Baltics, Sweden, Finland, all talking about nuclear weapons in their territory to protect them from Russian aggression. And Jeff, it was a puzzle to find something positive out of what all the work that you did 12 years ago to go forward with the present tangle. The only thing I could find that made sense to me, again, is to talk about conventional force treaty linked to Global Zero in some fashion. That didn't happen the first time. Can it happen the second time, Colonel?
I think it could possibly, John. It would seem to me in any type of a negotiated settlement, if we expect one to occur, there's liable to be a conventional force element that will mimic many of the things that we talked about in the conventional forces Europe negotiations. Because again, the Russians feeling very exposed on the conventional side, we want some reassurances that that large scale conventional assault from the United States and this NATO ally is not going to occur. And this was one of the goals of CFE back during the Cold War, was to prevent the sudden bolt out of the blue attack by one side against the other. We saw that actually integrated as well in other agreements. For example, the Dayton Accords that ended the conflict in the Balkans has a conventional arms control component, which looks very similar in structure to the CFE treaty in terms of what systems it limits. And this is to keep us, you know, security and the prospects of avoiding future conflict down between Bosnia, Croatia, and Serbia. So I think it's very possible. Secondly, of course, along the way in the Cold War, we created certain institutions that could be valuable in that post-Ukraine war type of a world. The Organization for Security Cooperation in Europe, which oversaw a lot of the CFE negotiations, and also has other agreements which are still intact, but I think not used very often, such as the Vienna document, which allows both sides to allow observers, if in fact they're going to do large military exercise above certain thresholds. And finally, I think I was a bit disappointed, frankly, when the Trump administration withdrew from the Skies Agreement, which I thought obviously was not a panacea, but again, provided some measure of transparency between both sides, which in time of crisis, hopefully would dampen things down.
What was Open Skies, Jeff? Define it for the audience.
Oh, Open Skies was an agreement between us and the Soviet Union and others, the Russian Federation, that allowed both sides to announce they were going to conduct an aerial overflight of territories in the United States, territories in the Russian Federation, to monitor activities, particularly with existing nuclear forces. And these were all pre-announced exercises. Aircraft would come over. They'd fly those routes. They'd be accompanied by people from our on-site inspection agency. And the film and photographs from those particular aerial overflights would become immediately unclassified and then could be shared with all the signatories to that particular treaty. So I thought it was a particularly useful device. Actually, it was initially discussed by Dwight Eisenhower when he was president in the late 1950s as a measure to reduce the possibility of escalation, and was brought into being during the administration of George Herbert Walker Bush.
In 2012, when you and your colleagues published this book and all of your contributors were a great detail to do the history, China was not part of the story. It was a different world then. Hu Jintao had just passed on the baton to Xi Jinping. Now China is part of this nuclear matrix. To your knowledge, does this create the same problem we have with Russia? Tactical nuclear weapons are a Chinese favorite?
Yeah, I have not seen a great deal in open source intelligence, John, about the Chinese moving forward in the development of tactical nuclear weapons. They seem more focused on trying to develop strategic nuclear forces, which would be roughly equal to that of the United States. And while the Trump administration insisted that future nuclear strategic discussions could not continue unless China participated, well, the Chinese have pretty much indicated they're not willing to do that until they reach that level of parity. But there are a couple other countries that have created such weapons that are worrisome. North Korea obviously continues to expand its nuclear arsenal, and there are certain reports that they may also be thinking about tactical weapons. And finally, we know the government of Pakistan has created an arsenal of about 170 to 180 nuclear weapons. So unfortunately, we see a bit of proliferation of these ideas and corresponding weapons around the world.
I thank Colonel Jeff McCausland, one of the editors and authors of Tactical Nuclear Weapons in NATO. I'm John Bell.
You're listening to CBS Eye on the World with John Batchelor.